spirituality based on the 12-step program of AA as a way for all of us to take a spiritual journey, a spiritual journey that has been fruitful for so many people around the world because we're all attached to something, be it alcohol or drugs or work or sex or relationships or power or control or shopping, any number of things we can get attached to and prevents us from living a full life. And as I mentioned last week, I admire the kind of authentic community that the 12-step programs create. So as a church, I think we can learn a lot from the 12 steps. So that's why we're taking this 12-step journey together as a congregation. Last week, we explored the first three steps of surrender, hope, and trust. And this week, we're exploring the steps of honesty, self-examination, confession, and humility to lead to salvation. In our society, it is very common to assign blame to someone else, rather than to attend to our own shortcomings and take responsibility for the ways in which we may have harmed others. We are often quick to assign blame to someone else, rather than look to ourselves and look in the mirror and become accountable for our own actions. We are discouraged, especially by how our legal system is set up, not to admit guilt, even when we know we are. I remember as a new driver, and I was off to university, and my family gave me the family car, my mother's car, to drive while I was at university. And as a novice driver, I was backing out of a driveway and not seeing the car that was coming down the street. And I managed to crash into it. And I quickly got out of the car, went to the very angry driver and apologized, said it's all my fault, I confessed my error, and handed over all of my insurance to the other driver. Well, then I went back to residence, and I called my lawyer father on the phone, who chided me at acknowledging my guilt. He said to me, "When it comes to the law, you never begin by admitting your guilt. You are innocent until proven guilty." He really was a man of integrity besides this conversation. But being a cheeky 19-year-old, I told him, well, it was my fault, and I needed to own that it was my fault. So I did. And he said, "That's all well and good. And what are you going to do about your insurance premiums going up?" Learning to be honest with ourselves and reflecting on the mistakes we make in our lives is an important step in our spiritual growth. According to all the books we read on life after death last year from January to May, all of the people who died and had near-death experiences shared that while they did not experience a place of eternal damnation, that there was no hell, we do all undergo an honest review of our lives, in which we understand deeply the ways we have both helped others and the ways we have harmed others, that we are indeed accountable for every word and action, and we begin to understand that and have deepened empathy in our spirit. So step four of the 12 steps helps us in some ways to prepare us for that eventual life review and provides an opportunity for us to do some self-examination of our own lives now. Step four made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. It requires honesty and courage and self-examination. Now, we all know it is not easy for us to search our innermost selves and discover the shadow parts of ourselves. And yet, as frightening as it might be to examine the lesser parts of ourselves, it's also extremely liberating. Paul understood just how defective human nature can be when he wrote to the church in Rome, "Yes, I'm full of myself. After all, I've spent a long time in sin's prison. What I don't understand about myself is that I decide one way, but then I act another, doing things I absolutely despise. The good that I want to do, I don't do, and the evil that I don't want to do, I end up doing." We human beings are full of that dualistic nature, full of contradictions and paradox. We may want to do the right thing, but we often find it very difficult to say and do it. The lesser parts of ourselves can trip us up every time. But I love what William Sloan Coffin, a Methodist minister in the U.S., puts it on one of my favorite videos. He said, "You know, I think the doctrine of original sin was the most optimistic doctrine that the church has ever promulgated, because it reminds us that at our core, we are not created in perfection. So we need to relax, settle down, take it easy, don't despair. We weren't made to be Boy Scouts." It is painful to take a moral inventory of ourselves, but it is exactly precisely these hard truths about our human selves that also sets us free to be better and do better. We move to step 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Confession. Confession simply means, from the Latin, with voice, to give voice. It is the act of confession to God and to another person that sets us free. I think the Roman Catholic Church was right about at least one thing, that confession is good for the soul. It relieves the mind of guilt and unburdens a heart that is heavy with hurt, of pain from the past, and a hope and a desire to begin again, to be made new. The psalmist who wrote Psalm 32 understood the pain of facing the shadow side of ourselves. The psalmist writes, "When I kept it all inside, my bones turned to powder. My words became day-long groans. The pressure never let up. All the good juices of my life dried up. Then I let it all out. And I said, I'll make a clean breast of my failures to God. Suddenly the pressure was gone. My guilt dissolved. My sin disappeared. There is nothing so liberating as giving voice to the ways we have wronged ourselves or others and unburdened our hearts and liberated ourselves from the heaviness of guilt." A contemporary study on mental health revealed that there were far less Roman Catholics in psychiatric institutions than other denominations, because it was the heavy burden of carrying guilt and pain that broke people's hearts and spirits and minds, that tortured their minds and memories. And because the Roman Catholic Church has a vehicle by which people can come and unburden themselves through a systematic confession, people often feel a sense of freedom and liberation in the Roman Catholic Church. A few years ago, some United Churches looked at the overall flow of our worship service, in which we always started off with a confession of sin. And because it was felt that this regular practice created too much of a focus on our lesser selves, and didn't create enough opportunity to celebrate the gift of life and the positives, that they decided to shift the flow of worship away from a confession of sin. And overall, I agree with that decision. Nobody wants to come to church and feel like you've done, you start off feeling terrible about yourself before you've even begun. So I thought that was a good move on the United Church. But I think once in a while during Lent or different times in our lives, we need an opportunity to do some self-examination and confess our wrongdoings and experience the liberation of doing that. So today, later in the service, we will have that opportunity to confess privately to God and experience the joy and liberation of the assurance of pardon. Steps 6 and 7. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, humility, and humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. These two steps require great humility, as we are reminded that we need a power greater than ourselves to step in and to help us make the transformations in our own selves we need to make. That by our own sheer willpower, we cannot overcome our own shortcomings. We need the grace and power of love of God. Humility is required. Now, humility is not about being humiliated and counting ourselves as worthless or inadequate. Humility comes from the same root as humus, which means earth, and is simply a reminder that we're made of the earth. When we say to ourselves, "I feel like a piece of dirt," it's literal. We are mortal and not God. We are not all-seeing or all-knowing. So to be humble means coming to terms with our humanity and not confusing ourselves by playing or pretending to be holy God with ourselves or anyone else. Paul was aware that prior to having an overwhelming spiritual encounter with the presence of the risen Christ, he had been mistakenly murdering new converts to Christianity, and he recognized that he had a hateful and murderous heart. And Paul was aware that it was only by virtue of that incredible spiritual encounter of the risen Christ as an act of grace that transformed his heart and changed his life and set him on another path altogether. And so he writes, "But I need something more. I obviously need help. I realize that I don't have what it takes. I can will it, but I can't do it. I decided to do good, but I don't really do it. I decide not to do bad, but then I do it anyway. My decisions, such as they are, don't result in actions. Something has gone terribly wrong deep within me and gets the better of me every time. It happens so regularly that it's predictable. I'm at the end of my rope. Is there no one who can do anything for me? Isn't that the real question? The answer, thank God, is that Jesus the Christ can and does help me." When you and I are at the bottom of ourselves and seem to have no way to go, when we surrender to that power of love, there is a mysterious and unseen force of grace that liberates and transforms our hearts and lifts us up and gives us a strength beyond our own to become a better human. When we are honest enough to face ourselves as we truly are and not how we wish we were, there is an unseen but deeply experienced and expansive grace that appears mysteriously and removes our hindrances one by one and helps us to develop free of them and saves us into wide open spaces. The old-fashioned word for that is salvation. The contemporary word for that is enlightenment. How does that happen for we humans? Rohr reminds us that we both need to prepare our minds and at the same time remain open to grace. In his book, Breathing Underwater, Richard Rohr puts it this way: God is humble and never comes to us if not first invited. But God will also find some clever way of being invited. Now would be a time that I would share a story of someone who experienced this process of radical grace and transformation. But better than me sharing the story of someone is to have someone come forward and share their story of these steps themselves. So I invited Lori Germain, who has led many 12-step groups, to share a little bit of her story of 4, 5, 6, and 7 to inspire us on our own spiritual journeys. Please welcome Lori.
Thank you, Jennifer. Oh, breath of life. I need to breathe. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for asking me to talk about the steps today. I'm always excited to share my journey and experience through the 12 steps, as it has been such a transformational experience and given me a spiritual program for living, a new way to live. So I was in the grips of alcohol addiction 22 years ago. I was introduced to the 12 steps in 1997 when I was at my lowest point. I went to a 12-step meeting and was introduced to a community of people who had been where I was. And they took me on this journey through the 12 steps. They told me that they had a belief in a higher power that changed their life, and that I could have a belief in any higher power. The God of my understanding was sure to come to me if I surrendered. So having no options, I had come to the end of myself, like Jennifer had shared. I surrendered to the only God I knew, which was the God of the Roman Catholic Church, who I was a bit afraid of. I was very fearful, and I had no faith at that point. So I admitted I was powerless over my addiction, and my life was definitely unmanageable. I was losing my family, my children were young, my job was in jeopardy. I had been to treatment over and over, and I couldn't stop. So they told me that if I surrendered to a power greater than myself, that this obsession, this compulsion would be taken away. So I did that, and I was soon told, okay, now what you need to do is go into step four and look at a moral inventory and be honest. And, and I was given a card. It was funny because the card said the gal in the glass. And it was like looking in the mirror, and this is what I had to do. If I was going to have what these people had, which was freedom. So I did the personal housekeeping, is what they called it. Steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. I looked at my liabilities, things that were blocking me from God, from living an honest and good life. And they were things like resentment and fear, selfishness, dishonesty. I had to look at my part in the situation. And they said, it doesn't matter what the other people did, but it's what you did. And I wanted to argue that. It was, but they did. And it was, no, this is about me and my freedom. So I got that all down on paper. I did a step 4 with an ordained minister, and I also did it with somebody from AA, another person. I admitted my part in things, and it was pretty miraculous, because it was almost like the scripture said, suddenly, and the pressure was taken off. It was like that. I could breathe, and I wasn't being condemned, and I wasn't. The fear started to go, and most of all, I started to trust the people who told me that this would work if I did this, and I surrendered to the God of my understanding. There's part of the 12-step program, it says we pocket our pride and illuminate every twist of character and dark cranny of the past. And, you know, I had to look at all of it and really let go and let God take this. As I continued, they said, you know, becoming entirely ready in step six meant that I was just willing. I had to start to be willing to believe that God would remove these defects of character, these shortcomings from me if I again surrendered, and that there was good and bad in me. There was assets that were there. It's just that I was blocked by these liabilities that no longer served me and were destroying my life. So I did that with another person. We have a step seven prayer in the program that says, strengthen the good in me and relieve me from the bad and these liabilities that kept my thoughts going in circles and my actions not pure and good. So in humility, you know, we did get down on our knees and we said this prayer and I surrendered again. And I was willing to accept the love and the support of the other people. And then they were showing me another way to live. You know, I felt forgiven and loved unconditionally. I no longer had that fear, the fear of the God that I only knew as a child. So my heart really, it changed. I just felt this newfound faith and trust, and I had a spiritual experience where I just knew deep down that I was pure and good and God was with me no matter what. So, you know, it was quite a gift. It was God's grace. The obsession was removed, and I started to have a relationship with this newfound God. I had a belief at the beginning of these steps, but as I went through the steps and let go of things, I started to have a relationship with that God that I understand today. So, you know, it's such a relief to unburden ourselves, and for me it was something that I needed to do if I was going to be free of this. Best of all, the 12 steps tell us that once we arrive at this place, then we can be of service to other people. And that's been the biggest gift for me, is that I can help somebody else and that it gives me a purpose and, you know, that they too don't have to suffer. So it's truly a spiritual program for me of living. Regardless of the addiction, it doesn't matter. Alcohol is only mentioned in the first step, and the rest of the steps are just a spiritual way of living. So I can never repay what I've been given. I can only do that through working continually on the steps, looking at myself, and trusting God. So I'm just really grateful to be here today. And thank you for the opportunity. Thanks, Jennifer.
So the choir is going to help each